Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Kessenberger. We are all about local food here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and this week we'll be talking about Central Indiana's ultimate local food fest. Dig In, A Taste of Indiana takes place August 28th in a new location, and we'll be talking with Festival Director Tom England, a regular guest here on the show, about the new location in Military Park. He'll also tell us what's new this year and what festgoers can expect next Sunday. And in keeping with our local food focus, we'll head into a downtown production kitchen to talk artisan gluten-free bread with new food business entrepreneur Haley McGinley of Native Bread. We'll get the story on her gluten-free artisan loaves and hear about how she launched the bread business. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Indiana's Top Food Fest is coming up next weekend, and I know that a lot of local food fans are looking forward to it. Dig In, A Taste of Indiana will draw 5,000 attendees who come to sample food from more than 40 Indiana chefs and drinks from Indiana's breweries and wineries. Now in its seventh year, A Taste of Indiana has become the signature event of the Dig In organization. I caught up with Executive Director Tom England on a busy morning recently, and he tells us what we can expect at this year's festival when it takes place August 28th in its new home in Military Park.
Dig In is a nonprofit for the promotion of Indiana food, agriculture, and beverages. And Dig In is the nonprofit that coordinates all of that. So we have an event the last Sunday in August every year called The Taste of Indiana, which everybody knows is Dig In. So that's at Military Park this year, actually, on Sunday the 28th.
So that's what's new, is that we have a new location for the festival. So how is that going to affect what people will see at Dig In?
Sure. So Military Park is actually four times the size of what we normally are in. So we have a lot more space, which means a lot more space to spread out in and a lot more shade. So, you know.
Now that's a great thing, because that's one of the things about Dig In, is that it's usually a very hot day, and you're out there in the middle of, you've been out there in the middle of White River State Park, which is, you know, much less treed than Military Park.
Yeah, I remember at one point last year looking at my thermometer and it said 102 degrees, and it was steamy 102 degrees. This year, actually, the weather looks really good right now. So, you know, we're looking at mid-80s, and, you know, low humidity. So hopefully that stays. But, yeah, we'll be able to have a lot more shade so that people can, you know, kind of spread out and enjoy the weather and eat all day instead of, you know, for the couple of hours they can stand it.
Well, that is true, because, you know, it is an eating festival. I mean, we're sampling lots of food. And so, you know, when it's hot and you're out in the middle of the park like that, you know, it can be a little overwhelming. So that's going to be a big change for the better this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only spread out to enjoy the shade more, but also spread all the vendors out. So, you know, you'll be able to walk around and see a lot more and taste a lot more. We have 25% new vendors there this year. So, you know, we've got 11 brand new restaurants that have never been in the park before. And so there's a lot more food that you'll be able to try, especially from outside the Indianapolis area. And so, you know, if you don't get out and travel a lot, you'll be able to see and taste some of the foods from Portage, Indiana, and Pendleton, and, you know, other places besides just here in the metropolitan area.
Now, it is the Taste of Indiana, so this is a natural progression for the festival. You know, that people, I'm sure they expect to see, you know, some of their favorite restaurants in Indianapolis, but this is kind of a very good thing for the public and the festival, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we do support the entire state, and the area, especially up there between Michigan and Indiana, is just a huge local foods area. And so bringing a couple of groups down from Mishawaka, South Bend, as I said, Portage, those areas through there, those restaurants are phenomenal. They're really killing it up there, and so they're coming down and really supporting the Indianapolis area too.
So can you tell us some of the places that we can look forward to that we might not be aware of?
Sure. So the 5280 Bistro, which is in the Portage area, we've had a couple of places coming down from South Bend the past couple of years. You know, there's just multiple coming from the J. Fords and Terre Haute that's been there the past couple of years. Of course, Rini's Cookies down in Evansville, which everybody loves. They love coming up and doing this event, too. So, yeah, different people from around the state.
Now, because you have the new people coming in, there are some places that aren't participating this year, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think a lot of people don't realize, but the Indiana market for chefs right now is crazy, and we can't hire enough chefs. There's not enough chefs in the state. And so restaurants who normally are there are saying right now that they don't even have enough employees to be able to support it. So unfortunately, we won't see Joseph DeQuiz this year. And Goose the Market actually won't be there as well. So a couple of big names that won't be there, but in their place we do have a lot of new people coming in.
So we have some new things to discover, even though we might not see, you know, all of our favorites. So what else, you know, in addition to the restaurants, which of course is the big draw, I think, at Dig In, what else can people expect to see?
Sure. As always, all the beer trucks. So we have, I think, close to 20 different beers this year, which will be there. The best taps in the state, you know. So each of the breweries brings their best beer and really shows off that one beer. A couple of wineries and, you know, the competition, chef competition. So we have 8 people competing for the best sous chef in the state. So that'll be a fun competition. And that'll actually be right in the middle of the festival itself in the circle at Military Park. So you'll be able to go in and sit down in the shade and watch the competition, which is run by Ivy Tech and is sponsored by Eskenazi Health.
Now that's nice because, you know, you've had the sous chef competition in the past, but it was a little kind of off to one side, maybe a little hard to get to.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, last year I remember people standing in the sun and, you know, trying to watch some of the competition. So we made an effort this year to make sure that it's in the shade, somewhere you can go down, sit down, eat, relax, and watch the competition. You know, we've got some really good competitors, but also the mystery basket foods are always fun to see what the chefs can do with.
Now, so Dig In is a year-round organization. So you've done events throughout the year, and some of that is going to be on display here at Dig In next weekend.
Yeah, so I3, which is Indulge, Imbibe, Imagine, connects chefs, bartenders, and artists together. So that event happened a couple of months ago, and the artists started working on different artwork. So they'll have that finished artwork at the event itself, the Taste of Indiana, so that people can see it and actually bid on it, too, to take it home with them at the end of the day. So some fascinating artwork from around Indianapolis. And the artists that put this together are really some of the best artists in the city.
Well, no, so that's really cool. Now, is that new? Is that a new thing this year to have the artists work on display, or have you done that in the past?
We started it last year, and we had them in a separate tent. This year, they're actually will be right in the tent with the chefs. And so as you walk around and get your food, you'll be able to see the art in the tent as well.
Now, tell me how the actual festival works. Do you have the passport system? Are they checking off as we get our samples?
Yeah, everybody's used to this passport now. So you pay one price to get in the door. Once you go in the door, you'll get a glass, a little sample glass actually this year. It looks like a little ball jar that you'll be able to taste the different beers with and the wines. And then you'll also be able to go around all the different food and try all the food. So there's no cost for you after you get in the festival, unless you want to buy a full glass of beer or a glass of wine. At that point, then you can go and buy a regular pint glass or a wine glass and try those things. But yeah, once you get in the door, you're not paying any of the extra money for all that food.
Now, what can people expect when they get to Military Park? Because since it's a new location for it this year, tell me a little bit about parking and sort of the structure of the event.
So the parking is always difficult. I hate to say that, but you know there's a lot of parking garages around the area. I recommend that people either park at the Government Center or over at the NCAA parking, which is on the west side of the festival site itself. The main entrance will be at the southeast corner of Military Park, so closer towards the canal. And so you'll be able to come in that direction. there's some lane closures that will be on Blackford Street, which is on the west side, and part of the Michigan Road might be blocked off as well, just for the festival traffic. So, you know, just plan on spending like a few extra minutes walking into the festival, and know that the parking is around. You just have to find parking in the city, which is, you know, everybody's used to that, I think.
And now tell me a little bit about the VIP experience, because that's a sort of premium that people can go for if, you know, if they want to do that. And that has, you know, some ramifications for parking and extra tastings maybe.
Yeah, so if you purchase VIP tickets, it allows you into an area that has four chefs that aren't in the common area. And so you'll be able to taste some of the best foods from places like Rook and Bluebeard. And also, you do get a full-size wine glass in the VIP area, and have some premium beers and wines in the VIP area that aren't in the common area. The big thing is there's big lounge chairs back there. There's heated air-conditioned bathrooms. And just places to be able to relax and get away from the heat and crowds.
So tell me a little bit about the different price ranges and the various ticket options that people have.
Sure. Right now the tickets are on a discount. On Thursday, actually, the prices go up to full price. So buy tickets now, the $40 general admission ticket or the $120 VIP ticket. There's also an early entry ticket, which I think is $90 this year. So, you know, the early entry and the VIP gets you in at 11 o'clock instead of noon, so you don't have to fight the early crowds to get into the restaurants. And so you'll be able to try quite a few of the restaurants before the general crowd gets in. General doors open at noon, and the event goes until 4.
Now, how many people do you typically expect? It's usually a sellout.
Yeah, so it does sell out. Last year we sold out by Friday before the event.
So there weren't any out-the-door tickets last year?
That's correct, yeah. And we're right on target to be at the same place we were last year. We do limit it to 5,000 people, and that's actually 4,000 paid, and then another 1,000 in volunteers, restaurants, the people working in the restaurants, the breweries, all of that. So there's about 5,000 people in the park. So the lines don't get too long because of that. You're able to move around the park and able to do everything because it's not a huge number of people. It's just a manageable crowd. A lot of people don't realize that Taste of Indiana is not a moneymaker. We actually lose money on this event. It's our mission to get out and promote Indiana food, beverage, and agriculture, and that's what we do with this event. And so people don't know that we're buying 100% of that food that's sold in that park. So we go out to the farm a lot of times in January and February when they're looking through seed catalogs and say, hey, we need 600 pounds of watermelons from you on this day in October or in August. And so it takes a lot of planning to get there. And we spend a lot of money for all those food items. So the restaurant doesn't go broke trying to provide it. And the farms aren't asked for donations for it. So we want to make sure that we're promoting without killing the restaurants and killing the farms. So we pay for everything, including the beer and the wine that's sold in the park. So, you know, for every keg that's poured, free samples, it's free to you, but it's not free to us. And so we're paying for everything. And so, you know, as a nonprofit organization, we need help to survive. And so this isn't just an event where we're making money. We're actually asking for donations as well. And so, you know, it's something we want to be able to go out and promote Indiana food and agriculture because it makes a huge economic impact on the state. So if we know that if each family just spent $1.65 on local food per week, it would make a $1.5 billion impact on the state. So we want to get that message out there.
We've been talking Dig In, a Taste of Indiana, with Executive Director Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College. Stay with us for more on Dig In here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and we've been talking today about Dig In, a Taste of Indiana. The local food fest takes place August 28th and will draw 5,000 people to its new location in Military Park in downtown Indianapolis. But how did such a massive event come about, and how do you keep a local food fest going? Dig In's Tom England tells us how the idea for a local food festival developed and what it takes to make it all happen.
It actually all started about 10 years ago. So the IMA, the Annapolis Museum of Art, was having a program, year-long program, on local foods and trying to get more local foods into the school system. And so the farm to school program. Several of the chefs actually were on that board and talking about that every month with the IMA people. So at the end of that, Alice Waters comes to talk to the general public, and three of the chefs were able to sit down with Alice Waters. So Neil Brown, Regina Mahalik, and myself sat down with her at lunch and literally spent 2 hours just talking about local food. And she at one point just said, you know, why don't you do a festival? Why don't you do the Taste of Indiana the way it's supposed to be done? And so we all kind of looked at each other and said, okay, let's do this. And
that was 10 years ago?
That was close to 10 years ago, yeah. So Neil and I, by the end of the day, even had contacted Department of Agriculture and Department of Tourism and got everybody involved. And so, you know, literally Department of Tourism, Agriculture, Farm Bureau, you know, all these people that were larger state agencies were involved in the development of this, which was very interesting because, you know, we're talking organic and we're talking sustainable agriculture, and these large organizations are starting to listen at that point. So we said from the very beginning we wanted everybody to sit down at the same table. And that's what, you know, all this started out as you know, how do we develop more food, edible food in the state of Indiana, as opposed to commodity foods? And so we've seen the state change. We've seen, you know, specialists be assigned in agriculture. We've seen the locally grown program start out of agriculture. We've seen, you know, Farm Bureau add two small farm specialists. You know, all this stuff happened because of what we're talking about at that same table with everybody else. And so Dig In, as an organization that promotes Indiana food and agriculture, we've seen all this growth. And Taste of Indiana, the festival itself, was started through that to say, okay, if you have this product, what do you do with it? Because as a society, we forgot how to cook. And so it was an opportunity for people to taste different foods from different chefs that you weren't used to seeing, and cooking them in creative ways. And so to give people more ideas of what to do at home, too.
How was that early on working with, you know, sort of the big ag component? Was there tension there?
Lots of tension. You know, from the very beginning, we had Slow Food members and Department of Ag in the same room. And you know, at first, nobody wanted to talk to each other. And definitely affected how we could do what we did, because big ag thought we were about small ag, and sustainable organizations thought we were about big ag, and so therefore nobody wanted to be involved at a higher level with Dig In. It's come around dramatically, and people understanding, you know, we support development of agriculture that is edible, and that makes a huge difference when people start to understand and talk to each other. Without a doubt, my understanding and my knowledge of food in general has grown because I'm talking to both sides of the equation instead of closing off and not understanding the whole picture.
Now, did that happen easily? You know, did it take some time? How did that evolve?
Yeah, no. After 10 years, we're still having the conversation. I mean, it's something that we talk about normally, and it's funny because it went from a private discussion to an open discussion, which is a great thing. I mean, that's the way we learn, right? Is by talking to each other. And so, like I said, I'm learning every day, and everybody on that board is learning every day about what each other does and why we do it.
Well, now, tell me a little bit about the structure of Dig In. So you have a board that oversees the organization and helps make it run.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we've 19 board members, so large board. And they're everything from lawyers to farmers to chefs and, you know, everything in between. And so even people that work at Cummins Engine are on the board. But it brings a whole lot of different thought patterns and growth of, you know, what does the average person at home want to learn about food or need to know to grow the economy? And, yeah, so that board helps us to develop. It helps us to continue to grow outside of the Taste of Indiana Festival. So, you know, we are out speaking at different organizations throughout the state about the impact of local food and connecting chefs and farmers together every day who don't really speak the same language and teaching each other how to work with each other. So, yeah, there's a large organization and a lot of stuff going on that people don't realize. From the Chef Farmer Collective, which is that group that gets together and talks about, you know, where to get food and what's in season. And then we have what's called an in-season program, so capital I, capital N, in-season, where we promote one food per month that's in-season at that point. And telling chefs, okay, this is what it is, this is the food history of it, this is why it's important to Indiana, and this is where you can find it. And so we give them talking points. So when they go out in the media, so when you hear people talking about strawberries in April, it's because of that information that we gave them and connections that we've made with them in the media to be able to get out there and talk about that.
So dig in, it really is what you've said before, a year-round organization. Now, what are some of the other events that go on throughout the year to help support the Taste of Indiana event that we, you know, look forward to in August?
Yeah, so we do two other events as a Dig In organization. So we do Munch Madness in March. So that is a chef competition. That's just a fun competition that gets people up on stage. We actually do a full stage production with this, and so you can come and watch the full. It's like a TV food experience, but in person. And then we do the I3 event, which is Indulge, Imbibe, Imagine, and that pairs the chef, a bartender, and an artist together, and they all have a common theme of an Indiana landmark. And so this year we did 19, I think, teams. And so you come in, you taste the different food with the drink, and see the artist doing the art all at the same time. And so you go to all 19 booths and kind of see all that happening.
So that's a very interesting, you know, way to look at food and Indiana. So how do these sorts of things come about? You know, how do the ideas develop?
Yeah. So the I3 event has been something that I've been wanting to do for many years. I think food is so artistic and drinks are artistic, and the chefs and the bartenders really think of what they do as a craft. And so it was just a natural kind of progression, I think, of, you know, this piece of artwork and how it makes me want to create different food. And so we thought, okay, well, let's just take it to the next level and create it all around a specific landmark in the state. You know, I think the next iteration is to have music that goes along with it, too, that's inspired by it all. So, you know, that will develop, I'm sure, over time. And you know, it brings in a whole new group of people to what we do, too. So one of the big things with local food in the state is that we have a core group of people that eat local food and go to the local restaurants. And it really hasn't grown out of that core group of people. And so we need to bring a new audience in to make that growth happen. Otherwise, you know, we have a lot of restaurants that do it, and they're fighting for the same people. And so we've got to bring new customers into those restaurants.
How has the local dining community changed over the years? Is that growing? Are we more receptive, you know, to something like Dig In or to something like I3, some of these more, you know, interesting events?
Yeah, it's interesting. When we started the first Taste of Indiana Festival, we couldn't find 12 restaurants in the state that promoted local food. I know there was a lot more using it, but nobody promoted it. In fact, the cover of one of the Indianapolis Monthly magazines was Chain City. And they were kind of proud of, you know, this is the place where the chain started and developed stuff. And now, and they wouldn't, a couple of people that I knew offered to do food articles about local foods, and the editor at that time said, there's just no market, people aren't going to read it. And now, if you look at the Indianapolis Monthly, it's all about local food. They tout how many restaurants we have and that use local food. And, you know, we have 50 restaurants in the park this year for Taste of Indiana. And we had to vet those to be the best of the restaurants across the state. So there's a lot more growth. There's a lot more people who want to be involved with local food. So you have
seen a lot of progress then over the last, you know, 10 years since you've been working on Taste of Indiana?
Yeah. Just in the metropolitan area, we can trace back $1.5 million impact that Taste of Indiana had on the local community in the past year. And, you know, that's just the growth of the new restaurants, what the restaurants are selling, the growth in local farmers markets, and what the farmers are producing for those farmers markets. I mean, it's a dramatic impact. And you know, I go to the market every week, and to see the number of people at the farmer markets, it was raining last Saturday, but it was packed at the farmer's market. Those are great things to see. You know, before I could go to the market and see the same 50 people. Now, you know, there's hundreds of people, and they're excited to be there. And, you know, it's that social time for them. So it's much more than just the food. It's the community development. And that's what makes me excited about it is, you know, people get out and talk to each other. They know their neighbors now. They're concerned about each other. And that wasn't happening before.
So are you encouraged about where Dig In has come from and where it's going?
Yeah, it's totally exciting to see what has happened in the past 10 years with local food and, you know, what Dig In has done to really promote use of local food. From the farmer side even, you know, to see people who are all about growing corn and soybeans before, who are growing asparagus now and stuff that they're having fun with as hobbies more than anything else. But, you know, they have a couple of acres of these crops that they're loving growing and you know, really getting out to visit neighbors and sell vegetables with. It's cool.
So where can people look for more information about Dig In, A Taste of Indiana?
Yep. So digindiana.org is our website. You can go there and click on festival to get your tickets. But you can also find a whole bunch of resources, including, you know, a seasonal map so you can see what's in season at different times of the year, as well as places to buy local food.
We've been talking with Tom England of Dig In, A Taste of Indiana. For more information and to buy tickets for the August 28th event, go to digindiana.org. Gluten-free foods have become a big thing, and as more consumers become interested in gluten-free options, the more options they want. When Indianapolis resident Haley McGinley went gluten-free, she missed the hearty, crunchy style of artisan breads that she'd always enjoyed. And so, with some encouragement from friends, she decided to make them herself. After perfecting some recipes, this summer she launched Native Bread and began making and selling her artisan loaves. Now she's got a little corner of space in a local commercial kitchen and is busy baking several different varieties. I stopped in at the kitchen recently to see what Haley was up to and to hear the story of Native Bread.
So literally, I was at the farmer's market, and it was actually the Broad Ripple Winter Market. And I really was craving some bread. There's great local bakers. There's Amelia's and Renee's Bakery. However, they don't make gluten-free bread. And I just had the thought one day that I really wished Indianapolis had a high-quality, gluten-free artisan bakery. And I said to myself, well, I can wait for someone else to do that, or I can do it myself.
And that is so cool. So, but now tell me about your background and whether, I mean, do you have any sort of baking background?
No, I don't. And that really held me up for a while in terms of, like, whether I should do this or not. And I would talk to my friends about it, and I said, you know, this is crazy. I have no experience. I never even made a gluten-free artisan bread in my life. I've baked a ton, but not gluten-free artisan bread. And everyone was just like, you know what, Haley? It doesn't matter. You can learn, and there's so many people out there and so many businesses that have been started by people who they didn't know what they were doing in the beginning, but you learn as you go. And I'm a fast learner too, so I'm just self-taught from the library and food blogs online.
So this is what you eat though. So you were looking for this because it's what you want in your own diet, right?
Right. Yeah. I'm very particular with my diet. So I wanted to create a product that I felt good eating and that I could feel proud to serve to the community as well.
Now, how does that start? How do you go about coming up with the kind of artisan bread that you were looking for?
Well, I started with breads that I would want to eat. I was like, what are my favorite kind of breads? And I went from there. And my favorite kind of breads are those really, like, dense, full of, like, the crunchy seeds and whole grains and things like that, like the darker, richer breads. But then I also have a sweet tooth, and I love sweet things. So I don't have it right now, but down the road I'm going to do like cinnamon buns and a cinnamon raisin loaf, and scones and different baked goods like that. And then I also have sourdough and a honey. So the honey oat loaf sort of satisfies that sweet tooth. And then the sourdough, I mean, everybody loves a good sourdough, and nobody's doing a gluten-free sourdough, so.
So what was the first thing that you made, and how did it come out?
First thing I made, I made a boule. It was just like a basic, sort of like a whole grain boule, and then that evolved into what I currently make, the seeded whole grain boule. And in the beginning, you know, I failed quite a bit, or I don't call it failures. You don't fail, you just get results, and then you learn from it.
How did the first ones come out? I mean, had you baked with, you said you hadn't done any gluten-free baking before.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I'm a visual person. I'm trying to picture. I mean, in the beginning, and even now, you know, I'll create a recipe and it doesn't come out quite right, and I just tweak it and change things here and there until it's where I want it to be. But yeah, definitely in the beginning, just they were not coming out great.
How did you tweak it? I mean, did you start out like basing it on recipes from here and there?
Yeah. I love food blogs. I've been hugely into food blogs for years once I got on this like healthy eating kind of lifestyle. So I definitely utilize the internet and food blogs quite a bit. And then I would go to the library and just check out like 10 books at a time. I also bought a whole bunch of books from halfpricebooks.com. And I found recipes that sort of fit the bill of what I was looking for, that, you know, used more whole grains, not as much starch, were dairy-free. But it was really challenging to find recipes that already existed that were dairy-free and soy-free and egg-free and all these things. So I had to take these recipes and then just substitute, you know, instead of using eggs, using egg replacers like a flax meal and things like that.
So these breads are not only gluten-free, but they're vegan as well?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, now you set yourself up for a big challenge in trying to do all this, you know?
Yeah, I know, definitely.
So you did kind of set yourself up for a challenge in trying to do this, right? So now tell me about what some of the requirements for the bread, because you just aren't looking for the easy gluten-free bread. You want it to be, you know, to have a lot of good things in it too, right?
Right, yeah. I want it to be, like I was saying earlier, something that I feel good eating and that I'm proud to give people as well. And so I wanted the breads to be dairy-free and soy-free and egg-free, and I don't use nuts either. Just really friendly for people that have all different types of allergies, you know, food allergies.
I bet that was hard, you know, creating those recipes.
It was. It was a challenge, but I feel like now I've nailed down the recipes for the breads that I have, and so from there it's easier to create new ones. But, you know, definitely I learn from the quote-unquote fails, the results, and but it's just fun. I love a challenge, and like I said, I'm a fast learner, so if I make a mistake, I learn from that mistake, and I can, you know, move forward, and it'll be way better even the second time I do it.
So now what are you envisioning down the road? I mean, are you hoping to expand the lineup and sell to restaurants and... Well, where do you see it going?
Yes, to all of the above. So when I first had this vision, that's exactly what it was. It was this grand vision of native bread being accessible nationwide. And however, I'm a local, you know, person. I love supporting local and eating local, shopping local, all those things. So, and I love Indianapolis. So my you know, initially my goal is to really make a name for myself in Indy and just get in as many local restaurants as I can and local grocery stores, and then just expand from there. And yeah, I've just always envisioned it growing and expanding so that I can help and provide the spread to as many people as I can, I guess. And I'm right now at the Garden Table in Broad Ripple, and also online at farmersmarket.com. So people can order online there. And farmersmarket.com is great because they will either deliver it straight to your door, or they have like close to 30 different locations around the city. So you can just find the location that's closest to you and go pick it up. And there's no delivery fee if you do it that way.
We've been talking with Haley McGinley of Native Bread in Indianapolis. We'll be back with more from Haley here on WFYI and WFYI.org. As I've said before, here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, the local food community here in central Indiana is so inspiring. People are willing to take a chance and launch a business, and the local food scene is richer for it. From cupcakes to ketchups, local food artisans are making all sorts of terrific products to give consumers something new, something that wasn't already in the marketplace. One such entrepreneur is Haley McGinley, who is looking for hearty artisan-style gluten-free breads at local farmers markets and decided she would learn how to make them herself. And the results convinced her that others would like her artisan gluten-free breads as well. And so she launched Native Bread. Haley tells us about starting the business and making her idea a reality.
I'm still very new to this game. And the thing that I'm finding is for me, it's one day at a time, one step at a time. If I think about everything that needs to be accomplished all at once, it's very overwhelming. And Hannah's been great with, you know, helping me and supporting me with all of that too.
Now that's Hannah Lindgren, who just recently did the Food First documentary.
Yes, yes. She's our marketing director. She's phenomenal. And so grateful to have her helping me through all of this.
When you first had the idea, how did you take it from a passing idea into a real business where we're in a commercial kitchen, you're selling to restaurants? So how does that happen?
Oh God, I don't even know. It's like my dreams are just answered every day. You know, I think I'm a big believer in the law of attraction, and I put it out there. I had this vision and this idea, and I told it to my friends and I told it to my family, and everybody was super supportive. And I just was like, okay, well, what's step one? What do I have to do first? So the first thing is I need to start baking, right? So I go to my favorite grocery store, Good Earth and Broad Ripple, and I start, you know, I buy the ingredients, and then I start testing recipes and letting my friends taste test. And so just starting really small and focusing on what can I do right now? What needs to happen right now? And then just moving from there. And then Hannah connected me with Chris Baggett, and then he graciously offered to let me sort of, you know, practice what it would be like to produce on a larger scale in his kitchen, that cluster truck.
That's right. So he has cluster truck and is part of farmersmarket.com and has become very active in the local food community. So that was another good connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. A great connection. And another resource that I used a lot, and I'm still seeing them, is SCORE. And they're a free resource for anybody, whether you're, you know, a brand new starting up a business or you're CEO, you know, of a huge corporation. They help you, they support you and give you resources and things like that.
This is the organization of retired executives who provide mentorship and counseling, right?
Yes, exactly. And they're great. They're so great. They're so passionate about what they do. You can just tell they love it. So I've been meeting with people at SCORE for, gosh, a few months now. So they were kind of the initial, my initial mentors in the game, and other than Hannah.
Now tell me what the time frame was. When did you said you started this, started thinking about it at the winter market. So how long has it taken?
not that long. That's the other crazy thing, is the response has been so positive, so quick. Yeah, I had the thought, and I'm really bad with time. It was in the winter when I had the vision and the thought, and then I just started testing recipes at home, and then...
So you were baking last winter, right?
This past
winter. Mm-hmm. Where did it go from there?
Right. I think the next step was letting my friends taste it, and then we met up with Chris and brought him bread to sample. And then we slowly started putting things out on social media. And once I felt like I had perfected the recipes I wanted to sort of launch with. So, you know, because I could just keep tweaking the recipes and keep tweaking them and doing that over and over until it's absolutely perfect. And then, you know, Hannah was like, Haley, you just got to put it out there. This is such good bread. People are going to love it. You just have to... do it. Put it out there.
Was that hard? Was that hard to sort of let go of the planning in the getting ready phase?
Yeah, it was. It was and it wasn't. There was a side of me that was super excited to get it out there and like, okay, let's just do this and make it happen. And there's another part of me that was like, oh my God, okay, once I put it out there, this is real. Like, it's happening. And now people are going to, you know, have certain expectations and I have to produce bread and, you know, so yeah, there was, both sides of that with me for sure.
So when did you launch it? When did you put it out there like that?
Recently, very recently. What is this? Almost, gosh, we're in August. We had a photo shoot. The thing that we were, waiting to do, we had a photo shoot at my house. It was a picnic themed photo shoot. Hannah did the photography for it. And with those photos, she crafted the website, and that was sort of when we officially launched. We had already done like little things here and there on Instagram mainly, but now we're loud and proud on Facebook, and we do Snapchat, and our, you know, our website's up and running. So that was all within the past month, I believe. I mean, it's been very recent.
So, you know, we're kind of moving toward the end of August. And so it's been within this past month.
Yeah. And, I'm friends with Jordan, the manager at the Garden Table, and she knew about Native Bread and was, you know, saying, okay, when are you going to bring us bread? We want to sample it. And so I took them a loaf to sample just a few weeks ago and maybe 2 weeks ago. And, they loved it. They were like, this is phenomenal. We want to sell it. Yes, 100%. Yes, we want to have your bread here. And so they're my first restaurant account.
Oh, that must be so gratifying to get that kind of response.
It's exciting, yeah. You know, I hope other restaurants want to get on board too.
Was it a little scary to be out there all of a sudden?
I don't know if scary is the right word. It more of, it's just kind of cool. I'm like, this is really neat. I'm really just excited that I'm creating something that other people like. And I, you know, when I had this vision, I really just wanted to make good quality bread, and I'm doing that and everyone loves it. So it's so awesome.
Now, what's the next steps? Where do you go from here? I mean, you're working in a little corner of a commercial kitchen. So what happens when you expand? Because this is probably going to go places, right?
Yeah. Yes. That's definitely my vision and my hope. And so we're currently seeking out a commercial kitchen that we would be able to have access to whenever we would need it, and also store our ingredients there. So right now I'm prepping everything at my house and then bringing it here to bake it. So there's a lot of prep work involved and time in that. But yeah, going forward, just once we find a commercial kitchen space that we can have access to whenever we need it, then that's when we'll really be able to take off and grow. And so for right now, we're just limited on the amount of bread that we can make. And right now it's just me doing it too. And I really couldn't have anyone else because it's such a small space. So,
so tell me, what products you have now and where you see the product line going.
So right now we have a seeded whole grain boule, a honey oat loaf, and a sourdough loaf. and each loaf is hand formed by me. And so going, you know, moving forward, I love, like I said, I have a sweet tooth, so I definitely want to do a cinnamon raisin loaf, cinnamon buns, scones, pretzels. I've thought about doing English muffins and bagels and pizza dough. I want to make an awesome pizza crust. So when I go to restaurants and, you know, pizzerias, I can order pizza and, again, feel good about it and not have to worry about waking up the next day with achy joints and a swollen face because of the inflammation from gluten. So
you have come at this from a health perspective, but I'm sure that you also are paying a lot of attention to the taste and the satisfaction, so it's not just healthy.
I'm definitely coming at it from a healthy that's my primary focus. And as far as, I mean, they really are nutrient-dense breads.
Now tell me a little bit about the ingredients that you're using and the ones you're trying to avoid, you know, to boost that nutritional value.
Sure. I use all whole grains. I don't use any white rice flour. I don't use cornstarch, so all the breads are corn-free as well. So I use the maximum amount of whole grains as I can, and the minimum amount of starches to still create a product that resembles and feels and tastes like bread. And the main grains I'm using are sorghum, brown rice flour, millet, teff, oat flour. The seeded whole grain boul, I use sunflower seeds, flax seeds, sesame seeds, and poppy seeds. And I'm sourcing ingredients locally, so the honey oat loaf, using local honey for that. We're still communicating with a couple different places to see which one we want to go with. So I don't want to say right now, but I think we know who we're going to go with. So local honey, and also getting organic ingredients whenever they're available. So sometimes things, you just can't get them organically, unfortunately, but whenever an organic option is there, then that's what we use.
And, you know, so you mentioned the sweet things. So you see yourself expanding in that way in the future as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also with savory. I've worked on a baguette in the past, but haven't been successful yet, so I'm still working on a baguette recipe. And then seasonal things for the holidays, doing, like, fun little pumpkin things for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And I love the holidays, so I definitely want to have something, you know, related, like a holiday-themed bread. And I also want to say, too, while I'm thinking of on the healthy point of the breads, I don't use any sugar either. So there's no processed sugar. I don't even use cane sugar. And maybe moving forward, when I do like a cinnamon bun, I'm looking at just using coconut sugar. So that's much, has a lower glycemic, you know, it doesn't affect your glycemic level as much as like cane sugar would. So being conscious of that as well.
Has it been challenging trying to do that, to, you know, use those sorts of nutrient-dense ingredients and still get a tasty, satisfying loaf of bread?
Actually, no. I don't think so. And so far, the response hasn't shown that either. I think the whole grains, they're very flavorful. And when you combine them, you know, there's each of my breads, there's a blend of different grains, so it's not all just one. And you can't do that with gluten-free baking anyways. You have to blend things together. And so, you know, and then I use sea salt and just a little bit of sea salt, and that just makes the flavor pop. And I just love gluten-free grains because they all have a different flavor profile, and combining them together just makes such excellent bread.
We've been talking with Haley McGinley of Native Bread. For more information and to order the vegan, gluten-free, soy-free, sugar-free loaves, look for Native Bread on Facebook or go to nativebread.com. It's late August. The kids are back to school. Even the college kids have moved back on campus and are ready to start the fall semester. I have a college student in her first apartment this year, so I don't have any more lunches to pack or uniforms to wash. Although there's still school supplies and books, so many textbooks. But I spent a little time recently browsing through an antique store for books for me, and the ones I found were all cookbooks, of course. Now, they're not really, really old books, but they are from the 1970s, so they're old enough to make them fun and kind of interesting to read. One that I really got a kick out of was A Galloping Gourmet Cookbook. Remember Graham Kerr? So I definitely have to try a few from him. Another one that I couldn't resist was a Jell-O cookbook called The New Joys of Jell-O. Lots of silly, fluffy desserts that I'll probably have to try too. But the one that I know I'll really use for sure is called simply Homemade Bread. Put together by the editors of Farm Journal magazine, this one is sure to be good, and I know because I have other Farm Journal collections. There are a few recipes in there that caught my eye, a spicy gingerbread that I can't resist, a few cornbread recipes that I'll have to compare to my mom's tried and true recipe, and even a pumpkin biscuit recipe. After all, it's coming up on the season for pumpkin spice everything. So I'll take some inspiration from Haley McGinley of Native Bread, who we talked to earlier, and I'll make a few bread recipes and enjoy my cookbook. And I'll try not to think about all those textbooks. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Chef Tom England of Dig In, A Taste of Indiana, which takes place August 28th in Military Park, and thanks also to Haley McGinley of the new gluten-free artisan bread company, Native Bread, and thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indy.